Conversation with Michael Toms. New Dimensions and our quarter-hour New Dimensions Cafe programs are now available worldwide as podcasts. You can find them at the iTunes Store and on many podcast sites and mobile apps. You can also find our podcasts and much more on our website, newdimensions.org.
I'm speaking with Willis Barnstone, the author of innumerable books, including The Restored New Testament and the Gnostic Bible, and a wonderful memoir with Borges on an Ordinary Evening in Buenos Aires. Willis, let's talk about the Restored New Testament. It's an amazing literary and historical version of the New Testament. And I think the attempt, right, was to preserve what you've called the original melody or the original song, the original poetry of the Bible. And the effort is also important because of your attempt to restore the original Greek, Aramaic, and Hebrew names that you felt were missing. Why is it important to restore the New Testament?
Well, the New Testament is thought of as a European invention. People have names depending on the country, like Paul, when his real name was Shaul, Saul in modern English. They have names like James, which is actually Jacob. The Germans are much better in keeping the original names. We have Johann for John, Sebastian Bach. And we don't realize that these were all Jews. There's no one in the Old Testament except for Pontius Pilate who was not a Jew. What else were they? In Handel, where you find in the Messiah some of the vilest words against the Jews, they venerate Jesus' circumcision, which is described in Luke. It doesn't make sense. However, if you understand, when you hear the names, that Mary was really Miriam, Maria is the Greek translation of Miriam, when you realize that Jesus was Yeshua or Joshua, and etc., then it gives a different cast to it. And so after a few, we tend now into modern translation, we translate, we don't say, some people say Canton, but Guangzhou we normally say now. In Italy, the city where Modigliani, the painter, was born is Livorno. But for years in all the English maps, it was called Leghorn. I think we can call it Livorno. That's not beyond the linguistic capacity of an Englishman. So we're doing better in doing that. And it also means, well, it means we will no longer be fooled into thinking that Christianity was not an early Jewish religion. It was for centuries. Paul was a Pharisee, very proud to come from the tribe of Benjamin. The big debate in the early years were between Paul and the other apostles. They said, you're straying from the Hebrew Bible. You must be orthodox. And Paul said, look, there are three things we have to do. People are doing that these days. We have to get rid of circumcision. And he went back to Leviticus and said, it's pretty grotesque to say it, but the circumcision of the heart is more important than of the body. Well, of course, he was using it metaphorically, but it is still painful even in translation to hear that. And he said, we have to be able to work on the Sabbath because it's good as any other day. And the idea of the food restrictions was purely a matter of health. We don't need it anymore. If we are going to get rid of circumcision, health, foods, and et cetera, then we will be able to spread our word. their word was actually spread because the Romans destroyed Israel in 70, the war, 66 to 70, and dispersed the Jews and the Christians all over. Otherwise, they would probably have been more or less forgotten religions. Both of them were wildly proselytizing. And so instead of being an insular book that might have been like a child in, I don't know, Iowa, picking up the Book of the Dead from Tibet, it became a world religion. Yes. Often strange things happen to change the world.
How has the book been received? Have you lectured at major universities?
I gave a talk recently at Harvard, which cost me part of an eye, on the Jews and the Christians. Is Jesus a Jew? Is Jesus a Christian? Is God a Jew? Is God a Christian? The New York Review of Books was very kind to me. Frank Kermode wrote his last piece. He called it a heroic achievement. He's our best biblical scholar. I must say he died shortly afterwards, so I feel a little guilty. I don't know. It's been better received than it deserves, but it's an important book, and it's a literary book. There was an extravagant review in Library Journal which said this is the most important translation since the King James, and we hope the future it will hold up as such. So it went to my head. I've been drunk ever since.
Well,
I don't drink, by the way.
I like our dear friend Houston Smith's distinction between spirituality and religion. He says the difference is the religion gives you community and traction with your spiritual beliefs. So I hope this book gets some traction in the real world. I'd like to turn now to another aspect of your prolific work, and that is as memoirist.
Yes.
And to launch us there, I'd like to begin with a photograph that I just saw of you walking with Jorge Borges on the streets of Buenos Aires a number of years ago, locked in arms with the wonderful blind poet. There's such a charge of intimacy and respect in that photograph. Could you describe your life and what compelled you to actually write it as a memoir, your life with Borges?
Well, I wrote it 10 years afterward. I was in Guatemala, and I wrote the first chapter in about 10 days. These things happen. You never know when the flow comes, but when it comes, you have to have a pen or a damn good memory. I wanted to do it because I realized that the anecdotes, and I had the material, and I had lots of recordings, were necessary, and it was a marvelous, marvelous time doing it. It was not the first memoir I wrote, but I think it was the last one, although I've written another unpublished one, yes. The first one was about my first 5 years in Europe, and the second one was about we Jews and blacks and with Komunyaka. I love doing memoir. And then that led me to prose. I was asked by a company to write a brief 20-page life for one of these big encyclopedias. So I gave them 150 pages. They paid me twice as much. And I did it carefully, realizing that was going to be half the book. And that started me. And like anything else, you know, one becomes a victim of circumstance. And I am a circumstantial villain and victim.
Do you have any models in terms of writing memoir? Thoreau, Rousseau, Annie Dillard?
No, I don't think so. I really don't think so. I just did my best. I didn't have anyone in mind, but we always have everybody in mind. But I am much more aware when I write poetry or fiction who has inspired me, but the memoirs, no.
When you were teaching creative writing and literature all of those years at Indiana University, right, did you ever recommend that students read biographies of great writers? Did that ever come up?
No, and the truth is that, alas, I taught creative writing only when I was on leave, because Indiana, which treated me very well, was also very, very territorial. I was in comparative literature and Spanish literature, and hence I was never able to teach creative writing. I'm pretty good at it. The closest thing they let me do is teach translation, which was part of the creative writing department. But I'm glad I was not allowed, because I think I'm a good editor of other people's work, but it was much better for me to read and try to speak about other writers. I'm not very good about speaking about prose writers because I don't have the habit, but I have written a book of short stories. I love short stories.
I'd like to talk also about collaboration. Mm-hmm. You have an unusual track record of writing with your children, translating with your son, Tony, and your daughter, Aliki. Mm-hmm. But you've also collaborated with your wife, right?
Yes, yes.
Can you talk about what that is like?
Well, it's wonderful. It's just wonderful. I mean, in Spanish, there's an expression which says, cuatro ojos ven más que dos, which means four eyes see better than two. And I think for writing, four eyes see better than two. Why not?
Can you tell the listeners at home what you've collaborated on with them?
Well, with my daughter, we did a book of women poets, which is a big, 800-page book now, of poets from antiquity to now. She was a freshman at Brown College at the time, and her picture was in Time magazine. It was very successful and still in print. And it sold instead of that copy of that reviewed her book or our book came out, and instead of selling 9 million copies as Time did, it sold 11.5 million because John Lennon was killed that weekend. And his face was on the cover, and there was the story. So that was a very, very sad thing. I remember I was in Pittsburgh giving a talk on St. John of the Cross at University of Cincinnati, and we both kind of wept on the phone about John Lennon. And we still weep about John Lennon. And what you told me about how do you get to America, could you repeat that?
Yeah, there's a wonderful story. When the Beatles came to New York for the first time, a reporter asked, "How do you find America?" And John Lennon leaned across the other three Beatles and said, "Turn left at Greenland." So, what do you recommend to people who are trying to collaborate? It can rip families and friendships asunder. Do you have a brief recommendation?
Well, I guess with any problem you have with people, flatter them. And you'd be surprised that you can walk on chocolate and taste it at the same time. It's very important not to be personally upset. Argue about things, but not people.
Wonderful advice. I'm speaking with writer, poet, translator, memoirist, teacher, painter, and sometime photographer, Willis Barnstone. If you'd like to know more about Willis, know about his work, you can go to his website, willisbarnstone.org. Or you can learn more about him and his work through the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org. I am Phil Cousineau, and you're listening to New Dimensions. speaking with Willis Barnstone, author of innumerable books, including many memoirs, such as With Borges on an Ordinary Evening in Buenos Aires. Willis, tell us more about writing memoirs.
Well, it happens. It happens, and you're happy when you do it. You have no idea you can do it until you do it, like most things in life, and then you simply obey the voice. And like Chinese poetry, it's overheard in your head, and you give it what form you need. But the best things are those which are overheard when you hear voices in your head, and you can be an obedient pen. Dante said he wrote nothing, he just obeyed. He obeyed the voices. Borges was about 7 in the morning. Two of us were going to go to the Andes on a trip together. And he was all excited because he was awakened by a bomb near next door. It was during the Dirty War. And it caused him to remember his dream. And it was a different dream. And this is what he wrote. And this had a big effect because this story gave him the title of his last posthumous book. And it's very complicated, but every last thing he did seemed to be related to this marvelous, invraisemblable tale. I wasn't awakened by my usual nightmare, but by a bomb a few buildings away. I couldn't get back to sleep. So I conceived the plot of a short story. I had to do it in my head. The beginning and end, they come in a flash. Later, I fill in the middle. I was tramping through downtown London, looking for a bed and breakfast place. Above a chemist's shop, I found a shabbily respectable place and quickly arranged for my room, encouraged to do so by the owner, who invited me to afternoon tea. When this tall, ugly, intense man had me alone, he said, "I have been looking for you." What he had up his sleeve, I couldn't tell, but his glare almost paralyzed me. In those days, at least in the hour of my dream, I could perfectly see. "What do you want from me?" "Just £1,000. "You can't get what I don't have," I said to him defiantly. "I'm not here to steal. I'm here to make you the happiest man in the world, and only because you are worthy of it. I have just acquired Shakespeare's memory. If you're willing to forget who sold it to you, or that you ever laid eyes on me or stayed in my rooms, I will go ahead with the transaction." I took his bundle of papers, read one glorious, lucent page, picked up the phone and wired Buenos Aires for my savings, cleaning out my miserly lifetime account. By then, I could not remember a word of the burning text of Shakespeare's memory, and the multiple shocks woke me up. I came out of my Shakespeare business quick, clean, and empty-headed, except for the story. His last book was called Shakespeare's Memory.
It's a transportive piece. It reminds me of you citing Emily Dickinson in your epigraph to the Poets of Ecstasy. "To learn the transport by the pain as blind men learn the sun."
What did I say?
In your epigraph to your marvelous book, The Poets of Ecstasy, yes. From Sappho to Borges, yes. As a matter of fact, you use Emily Dickinson, one of our great poets, a couple of lines from her poems where she writes, "To learn the transport by the pain as blind men learn the sun."
Oh, how beautiful. How beautiful Emily Dickinson is. She's a constant surprise. She's certainly... there's no greater poet in the world than Emily Dickinson. There are many people who deserve that epithet, but she's certainly marvelous. She bowls you over all the time.
The connection for me between the two is this notion of transport, of being carried away mm-hmm. by poetry, by the epiphany, by spiritual experience. Yes.
And the blindness.
And the blindness.
Well, the blindness is obvious because you have to know nothing in order to see. You have to see nothing. I mean, Plato has it in the famous tale of the cave. You have to, you go out, you're blinded ultimately by the sun. At that moment, you can see all. We know that. It's simply a psychological notion. If you see with remembered thought, you will not see. If you see fresh, you will see the first day of the world and even the day before the first day.
Or perhaps see, as you again in that same book cite John Locke, whether that which we call ecstasy be not dreaming with the eyes open.
You only dream when your eyes open, even when they're shut. It has to be that way. Machado always was dreaming with his eyes open.
I think Pierre Mondrian said the same thing. I paint in a dream, and I want people to look at my work as if they're dreaming with the eyes open. It's a theme that seems to cross over in the different art disciplines. And ecstasy, to me, is an element that crisscrosses all of your work. Is that true?
Well, it is.
Or the ecstatic.
I'm going to publish a new book, one of these biggies, which will be called Ways of Ecstasy from Eve to Jack Kerouac. I used to know Jack Kerouac. We used to dance Greek things together. He said it was great fun. And what a tragic end he had to his life. But Jack Kerouac, the son of Jack Kerouac. By the way, I mentioned it, I'm sorry, because Jack Kerouac wrote the first version of On the Road in French, in Joual, in Quebecois. It was called Sur le Chemin. Not many people know that. They said he wrote it all in 7 years revising. He did it in 20 days or 2 days, whatever it is. A lot of nonsense. But he worked in a very disciplined way. And Nel mezzo del cammino di nostra vita, the first line of Dante, that's what inspired him for On the Road, in the middle of the road of our life.
I love him even more.
Yeah.
Thank you for that. One of your descriptions of the word ecstasy, the state of ecstasy, the experience of it, is elsewhere.
Yes.
And I love that because it also reminds me of Hugh Kenner, if you remember the great critic.
Yes.
I believe his last book was called The Elsewhere Community. Mm-hmm. And he felt that that was one of the things that brought creative people together from all around the world.
Of course.
That often we have more in common with other people who are creating than we might have with our own friends and family. Is there a longing in creative people for this elsewhere state of mind?
Well, I think so. It's the notion of make it new, be different, and all that stuff. Ecstasy means being not stasis, which means standing still. In Greece, when you stop for a bus, you go to the stasis, which means the place you stand. And we always have to stand elsewhere to see. It's just a trick of psychology, trick of the mind, and it works beautifully.
You've named a few of what you call the masters and mistresses of ecstasy, a marvelous phrase. St. Teresa of Avila, Sankara, Riesbrook, the mystic, St. Catherine, St. John of the Cross, Jack Kerouac. What would it give us to read, have a steady diet of the ecstatic poets?
I guess you'd puke, but I better, because, you know, ice cream can be had only in a certain amount. But no, I'm forcing the joke there. I think you can't live forever on the peak of ecstasy, but when Jack Kerouac was saying that he called climb Tamalpais at about 4 a.m, and Jack was saying, I climbed Tamalpais. I got to the top, and I saw it. I had Satori. And Corso was by him. He said, you saw bullshit, Kerouac. And Kerouac responded, I saw bullshit. You're right. So well, people are moderate. They're moderate.
Then he later used it in a book titled Satori in Paris.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, he went back to Paris to go to the Bibliothèque Nationale to look up the family roots of the Kerouacs.
Oh.
And he had another epiphany or a Satori moment there as he was able to track his people back to Brittany.
A very tragic, wonderful... He was reading a plays by Chekhov when he died, and he suddenly vomited blood. It was in Florida, and his last words were, holy shit. But he was by then quite wasted. He was in his mid-40s. He never recovered.
there's often a dark ending for people who are trying to follow the ecstatic for an entire lifetime. But there's also this lure. It's a kind of gravitational force that's pulling us towards what you call the secret wisdom. And you've described it as deriving from the dark night of contemplation.
Mm-hmm. The night of dark contemplation is St. John of the Cross's La Noche Oscura del Alma, the dark night of the soul. And it is in that night of the dark soul that he rises to the light of the sky. A St. John of the Cross, his father was a converso, that is to say, the Jews who remained in Spain, about half of them remained, and his father was a silk merchant. His name was Yepes, from the word Haifa, and his wife was a Moor. Her Spanish name was Catarina Rodriguez. So it was nice to think that a Jew and the Moor gave us Spain's greatest poet.
What's the role of the poet today?
The role of the poet is to sing and to speak. It's important to think politically as well. I mean, all poetry in the past is almost exclusively lyrical, as it must be, of politics or religion.
Well, thank you for a transportive conversation, Willis. It's really been marvelous. I've been speaking with Willis Barnstone, one of the most prolific and acclaimed writers and teachers of our time. He's the author of several classics, including Ancient Greek Lyrics and the new Restored New Testament, mm-hmm. The Poems of Jesus, and a wonderful book of poetry, Dawn Cafe of Paris. If you'd like to connect with Willis Barnstone or know more about his work, you can go to his website, willisbarnstone.org, or you can find him through the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org. I am Phil Cousineau. You've been listening to New Dimensions. This is program number 3535.
New Dimensions Radio has been making a difference on our planet since 1973, thanks to the generosity of our listeners. You too can help make a difference with a tax-deductible donation or membership. Please visit our website, newdimensions.org, and just click the donate button. You can also subscribe to our free weekly podcasts and find over 1,000 hours of audio dialogues in our searchable archive. New Dimensions is produced by New Dimensions Radio in Santa Rosa, California, USA. Our executive producer is Justine Willis-Toms. Our post-production editor is Lou Judson. For over 4 decades, New Dimensions has been producing weekly conversations at the leading edge. We sincerely thank all of you who have supported us by being members of Friends of New Dimensions, as well as members of our affiliate stations. My name is Dan Drayson. On behalf of everyone at New Dimensions, whose endeavors make this program possible, I'm wishing you well. New Dimensions Radio is an independent producer supported by listener contributions. To find out more about the program you've just heard, to subscribe to our free weekly newsletter and our New Dimensions and New Dimensions Cafe podcasts, and to access thousands of other programs in the New Dimensions archive, please visit our website, newdimensions.org. That's newdimensions.org. Or call us at 707-468-5215. That's 707-468-5215. Please join us next time as we explore New Dimensions. New Dimensions is brought to you by Friends of New Dimensions membership support and by Larson Publications, publisher of the book An Open Life, Joseph Campbell in Conversation with Michael Toms. New Dimensions and our quarter-hour New Dimensions Cafe programs are now available worldwide as podcasts. You can find them at the iTunes Store and on many podcast sites and mobile apps. You can also find our podcasts and much more on our website, newdimensions.org. Each week, New Dimensions explores the social, political, scientific, environmental, and spiritual frontiers with some of today's foremost social innovators, thinkers, scientists, and creative artists.
Hello, I'm Linda Graham, author of Bouncing Back. Next time on New Dimensions, I'll be talking about rewiring your brain for resilience and well-being.
Stats can be hard to understand, but this one isn't. Nearly 1 in 4 people can't afford food in Canada. What does food insecurity look like where you live? Look up your address at foodsecuritynow.ca. That's foodsecuritynow.ca. Join Community Food Centers Canada in making a difference today.